Hello, discerning podcast listeners. This is Tom Kenny, and you are listening to the GeekCast Radio Network.
Hello, and welcome to episode 208 of The Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo, and joining me today, as usual, is the Comic Concierge. Hello, Dan.
Hey, how are things?
Things are going well, a little crazy, but going well. I feel like this time of year, it's always a little crazy as you get after like the post-holiday slash, I don't know what it is, like between the Super Bowl and like weather and different things. I just feel like January, February is always a little bit crazy, at least for me. I don't know. How are you doing?
Better now. We had to skip. We were recording a week late because of me, because the flu hit my household. My kid got the flu and strep, and then I eventually got it as well. So that was not a fun time. I had like no voice to even record, so it was like, well, that's not happening. But luckily, but somehow my oldest son was unscathed. But you know,
wow.
Well, either crazy. He was patient zero and everyone else got sick, or he's just. All those vaccines worked. I don't know.
But, right. Something.
I'm just happy to be able to breathe again. So that's good.
Right. There's been a lot of stuff going around since the beginning of the year too. I think that's added to stuff. Cause we were all sick like the first week of the year. We basically spent New Year's Eve sick. And like a lot of my people I know at work have been sick, and it's been a thing lately. So hopefully hopefully it'll get better here soon. So everybody can get back to normal. But we're here today to continue our journey through the Alfred Hitchcock filmography. We're covering 10 Alfred Hitchcock films. Today marks number 4 on that journey. So we're at the 40% mark. See, the math's easy when you just do 10. I can do that all day. So today we are covering the 1951 psychological thriller film noir entitled Strangers on a Train. And I know we talked about it briefly at the end of the episode last time, Dan, but just in case people didn't listen to that one, what is your history background with Strangers on a Train?
Well, this was one I had watched before. I realized it was before Letterboxd even existed. So it was like, you know, 12, 13 years ago. But I had this was a rewatch for me, which I definitely realized as I was going through it that I've seen this before.
Oh, did you remember a lot of it, or was it a little bit foggy for you?
I remembered like the tennis piece, and I just remembered like the overall plot of it. But like I completely forgot how it ended, like the carousel sequence and stuff like that. That I didn't remember, but I just the beginning, it just felt familiar. So
gotcha. So as we said, this is obviously directed by Alfred Hitchcock. It says the screenplay is by Raymond Chandler, and I'm not going to try to pronounce that name. Senzi. I guess I am going to try to pronounce it. Senzi or Mond. But according to most things I'm reading, Raymond Chandler really didn't have much to do with the final product. He did not get along with Hitchcock. They had a falling out and he was replaced, but he still got credited. So I'll take that for what it is. Starring the likes of Farley Granger, Ruth Roman, Robert Walker, Patricia Hitchcock, Alfred Hitchcock's daughter, Casey Rogers, and a few other folks. Obviously, one of those folks is someone who we just talked about when we talked about Rope. Farley Granger had played Philip in that film, the not as dominant main character killer, I guess you could call him, in Rope. And now he plays the main good guy in this film, Guy Haines, opposite of Robert Walker's Bruno Anthony. And this film is about two people who meet on a train, as the title alludes to, which it was interesting for me because this is a complete first time watch for me. And I don't know why, but for the better part of my life, I thought the whole film was going to take place on a train. And I quickly found out that that's not what this is about. But not that it's not a negative about it or anything. I don't know why I thought the whole thing was going to take place on a train. But obviously, these two guys meet on the train. They have some discussions, which one of them is obviously taking way more serious than the other. And the idea of exchanging murders comes up, where one person can get rid of somebody that's a pain in the other person's behind, and then the other person can reciprocate that favor for him. And then it kind of goes down that path as the one of them is obviously trying to actually act out on this exchange, where the other one wants nothing to do with it. Got a novel. He's an architect. In the movie, he is a tennis player. So we also get something that I'm not saying this is like the earliest, because there's a lot of films that come out before 1951, excuse me, but it's one of the earlier instances that I have seen a movie of that you could almost like qualify half of this film as like a sports movie. Maybe not half, but like there's definitely more sports sequence than I was anticipating as well. And it's kind of interesting for me because 2024, which just ended, obviously had the movie entitled Challengers, which is about tennis players. And so there was a lot of parallels that you could draw between the two as far as how they're shot when it's the actual tennis sequence, which I found somewhat interesting. But what was your initial take here on Strangers on a Train on this rewatch?
Going back to it, like rewatching it, one thing I think, you know, we talked about with Rope last time, how the premise of it like kind of didn't work, and that kind of hindered the overall enjoyment. I really love the premise here. I think this is like, you know, it is one, you can understand nearly everyone's motivation and understand, like, usually when someone doesn't go to the police or something like that, it's kind of like, why wouldn't they just do that? But here, right, it all makes sense, because it is this happenstance. It makes you wonder, like, how much of this was planned by Bruno? Is he just like this? Like, he clearly sought this out. And just the machinations of how it undergoes Robert Walker is so good in this. Like, I think he was good in Rope too, but like, he's charming at times.
You mean
like
Farley Granger or Robert Walker? Farley Granger was the one in Rope. Robert Walker is the bad guy in this one.
Yeah. Yes. Sorry. Robert Walker, but both were really good, but I thought Robert Walker was especially really good in this, because like, you could see him be a bit charming, but like, he seemed like this bit of like, you know, sadistic at times, mm-hmm, in a way. Like, and it was, I really appreciated how you had a lot of scenes that just took their time. You know, you have the carnival scene that leads to the first murder, and it really makes you wait for it. You're anticipating it. That even gives you like a nice fake out is in first when they're like going through the tunnel, and you hear the scream, you're like, oh, there, that's when it happened. But then you find out it didn't occur. But I thought it was really good. I really enjoyed just the concept of it, you know, how it all came about. And the only thing that lost me a little bit was like the finale of this, the sequence with the carousel. I don't know. I just, at times it felt like, I was like, is this meant to be funny? Like, I almost felt like there's a bit of comedy there that I didn't know if it was intentional or not intentional, because it's, you know, it's on a carousel, and it just seems like a really random place to have this, you know, massive showdown or whatever you want to call it. But beyond that, I thought there's a lot of interesting ways that approach the story, using the backdrop of tennis, and you can see a lot of that playing into the plot as well, like this consistent back and forth.
Yeah, there's a couple things here that I just felt like were done to a more effective manner. You brought up Rope, and I feel like one of the things that for Rope didn't work for me is that it's a quote-unquote suspense or thriller that I didn't feel any suspense or thrill from in a lot of ways. I'm not saying it was completely amiss, but like it just wasn't maximized. And in this one, you get that like in spades. Like, there's, from the initial meetup between Bruno and Guy, you're wondering like, how serious is Bruno, right? Like, you kind of have a feeling that he's not all, I don't know if not all there is the right term, but like that there's something amiss, right? Like, there's something off with him, in the same way that you see from the characters in Rope. But then you're trying to, the ones in Rope, there's no suspense because they commit a murder immediately, right? So like, there's no like, are they just talking about it or are they going to do it? Where you have a little bit of that here, where you're like, okay, this guy's a little off, but is he, how far is he going to push this? Where is he going to go with it? And then you have a little bit of suspense with Guy, because you're trying to figure out if he's going to intentionally or unintentionally become a part of this, like, is he going to come around? Because there is definitely a sequence in the first third where Guy is, because let me back up. At first in the train, you're clearly seeing a dichotomy of like one person that's a little crazy and the other person wants nothing to do with him. And you're like, there's no way he's going to willingly go along for this, right? He's going to humor the guy and be polite because they're on the train, and then he's going to like find a way to get away from him, and that's going to be the end of his interactions with him, like if you take this into like a real world setting. But then there's a sequence in that front third where Guy has a meetup with his current wife, and I feel like that's such a intelligent and important sequence and scene to include in the movie, because there was definitely times during that sequence where I was rationalizing in my head how this guy is going to say yes, or like how he's gonna like be a willing participant in this nonsense that they were talking about on the train. Like there's a split second, or at least a few moments where I'm like, oh, he might actually get involved more than I think he's going to. Now he doesn't ultimately, but like there was at least that moment where I'm like, he might actually participate. So like even from the premise and like the onset, like I feel like there was a little tension and there's a suspense that's built in immediately, which I definitely appreciate how this one starts in respect to like how Rope started, because it just builds it in more. And then I feel like you get a lot more of that than throughout the rest of it, because then we're introduced into this situation where he's not a willing participant, but there's going to be a number, like a series of things that Bruno is going to be doing to try to force him to be involved, right? Like there's lots of little different ways that he's interjecting himself into Guy's life, sending him things, you know, putting more evidence out there that's going to eventually possibly force him to take an action. What that action is, where that's the suspense. But so I feel like there were just these like little moments built in throughout that like really aided the suspense part for me. How about you?
Yeah, I think you make a good point regarding like making you wonder like how much would Guy actually buy into it, because you know, clearly he doesn't seem like someone that would murder anyone, you know, right. You know, just because, but he's also in a situation where he has no escape from. And this guy's making good points, like this, you know, can he be tempted? You know, and I think that's something that this had, was you had those characters that had the opportunity of being tempted, in this case, Guy, and even, you know, his new relationship as well. And you kind of see them kind of get sucked into that world, trying to, in one of those things where, you know, you try to escape, you know, like quicksand, but the more they do, the more they get sucked in.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was very effective, and how it approached that. Just like this unnerving aspect of it where, you know, it felt good where you had characters that would talk to one another.
Yeah.
And it wasn't always, I feel like sometimes there's a show we watched called From. I like it, the show, but it's like one of the biggest things about it is that so many problems could be solved if people just had a conversation. And this had all those conversations, you know, like, you know, Guy talking to his, I guess you wouldn't say girl. I don't know what her relationship was, but just like she figured it out. And, you know, rather than him denying it, they kind of had that. It felt kind of like, oh, good. They're not just like, they're people are acting normally. And
yes.
Which outside of Bruno, of course, who's a little crazy, but you kind of saw that, like he had that, he felt like a Hitchcock character, right? Because as you mentioned, you brought up many times regarding how Hitchcock loves characters that have clearly weird relationships with their mother. That's definitely Bruno. But
we get a couple of those things. We get like the relationship with his mother. We get the person that is innocent that is not necessarily on the run, but like in a defense mode, where we've seen, you know, that's obviously what we saw in the 39 steps, specifically. So like, we definitely are seeing a lot more of like the Hitchcockian aspects in this. I agree, but I think and I'll let you continue. I didn't mean to cut you off, but the other thing that you said, like these people are, it's not just that they're having conversations, but they're having real conversations. Like they're having conversations that you believe the everyday person would have in these situations. So it's not where they're either number one, just not talking, or number two, where they're like having these like And I'm all for like some clever dialogue in movies. Like I love that in situations, but like this doesn't call for it. And so they're like having real conversations that you can picture like friends or family members having if they're in this situation or as they're trying to work through this. So it made it, it added a sense of realism that otherwise you could have gone like, you could have really amped this up in this film and made it just like completely like, I don't know, like gone too far with it to me in a way that it wouldn't have felt real. And I appreciate like the restraint that he had to not do that here.
Yeah. There's restraint all over the thing. That's a good word. Cause a lot of like the, you talked about this had a lot of suspense to it as you'd hope for a thriller. And a lot of that just happened in a lot of scenes where there was that restraint. Like when you had Guy going into Bruno's home and it's just him walking down the stairs. It that scene goes on for quite a while. And not a lot of conversation, you know, it's just like, is he gonna do it? Like it,
right?
It did a really good job of just letting that play out to eventually where it comes to its conclusion. And I think that in like I mentioned too, in the first carnival scene, which one, I want carnivals that have boats like that, like where they can go on a boat and like you just go out into a little island and stuff like that.
I don't know if I need them with the Cupid dolls though.
That's true. You wonder, it's like, yeah. It's
although he never got the prize for hitting the hammer all the way up. They immediately show him in the next sequence, and he's not carrying around the creepy doll. So,
but just I guess gave it to a kid or something. I don't know. Maybe the kid that he popped the balloon of with his cigar. But yeah, so that I think restraint's a good word because I think there is a lot like. Where Hitchcock just allows scenes to play out and like gives them time. And I think that was very effective here.
Yeah. And I think another thing too, you mentioned, I'm glad you brought it up because there's a couple of sequences here where yes, you know, the movie's from 1951, a lot of people have seen it, this, that, and the other, but I think it did a good job too, of not necessarily for a first time watch, not telegraphing what, and it's not like the whole game where like you're trying to predict what's happens and if you can predict it, it's bad. And if you can't, it's not, you know, or whatever that type of thing is. But there's like legit moments in here where you, as a first time watcher for me, I wasn't sure which way they were going. Like I wasn't going to predict the events that happen when he visits Bruno's house. Like when he goes to, you know, not like, I don't think he had been there. Was that the first time he was there? Was he only there once?
Yeah.
I think so. So like when he goes to that house, like, you know, I'm not predicting what's going to happen when he gets up, you know, up to the top of the stairs. And I'm also not going to, I wasn't able to predict what was going to happen when he's going down those stairs. Like there was multiple points in there where I'm like, which way are we going here? And is it going to happen like this or is it not going to happen like this? So there was like suspense within that too. That was like, it helps when you have little moments like we talked about before that are just naturally adding suspense. But then when there's situations here where you're legit like not seeing what's coming, like that adds another level of suspense. So I feel like you know, that's all over this place. I think restraint is a good word to a point, because I think he shows a ton of restraint through like 90% of this movie, and then it's like he was showing so much restraint that he just had to like let it all go in like the final sequence. Like Amanda has been watching all of these films or most of them with me. And that sequence happens, and we're just like, "Oh, we're going there! Yeah. Like this is happening! Like what is going on? It's a little off the rails, crazy." And no, you know, pun intended, I guess. But but there's like one moment where he doesn't show restraint.
Yeah, because it starts with a cop just shooting into a crowd of people, which and then kills the guy operating the carousel, which also makes you wonder, like. They made a carousel go that fast, but I'm like, I guess it's the 50s. They didn't have the regulations they do now. So it's, and then
seems like a bad design.
Yeah. Like that's what I did feel like at times, like that scene was meant, I don't know. Like, I don't know if it was meant to be as comedic as it came off at times. Like sometimes it was, cause you had the police arguing, cause you had just have this old guy just nonchalantly going under this speeding carousel, which apparently he really did.
Yes. Strange. I read that too. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that's the police crazy. Are like, you know, you want to stop him? He's like, I'm not doing it. I'm like, but it was just every time they cut to that guy, though, it just felt really funny because it's just like he was so unmoved by it. He's just like, I guess I got to do this now.
Right.
And then
I feel like the people at the time, though, probably didn't find it as comedic as we might now, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it almost feels like it could have been like an Austin Powers scene because they're on a carousel and like you fall off. It's like 2 feet. I guess they're going, maybe if they're going super, I don't know how fast they could.
I've never seen a carousel go as fast as that thing seemingly was going.
No. Yeah. That's the one part where I'm like, all right, this felt like, you know, that when you get to the Marvel movie where it's like the unnecessary, just way too long, final battle sequence that goes on forever. I mean, that felt like that version of it for that time. Mm-hmm. Where you have this crazy, you know, carousel thing. I mean, it was like exciting, I guess, and entertaining, but it did go, and then it's destroyed. I don't know. I was like, I almost wonder too, speaking of the ending, if maybe Hitchcock originally wanted maybe a darker ending than it has, because it hints that it's gonna end up pretty, you know, like everyone loses in the end, but it doesn't go that way. It almost makes me wonder if like that was what he wanted to do, but with the movies of the time couldn't exactly do that.
Yeah, I could see that totally, because there is a lot of writing on this film about how like they're really trying to make these two characters, talking about Guy and Bruno, as a lot more similar than you would think on the surface level. Like just that the way they shoot this and everything, like especially the introductory sequence where they're showing, you know, they're taking the same path onto this train, you know, they might be wearing different shoes to like differentiate the two of them, but like there's a lot of like showing these two. I don't know. I read somewhere that they even use the word doppelganger, which I don't know about that because they don't look alike at all. In my opinion, but like there was some things that were trying to like get them to be seen almost as very similar. Even though they're obviously very different individuals. So like I could see that being something where he was going to let them all, you know, come to a more grave end. What did you think of the, so obviously he has, I guess you could call it a love interest that is not at the time his current wife. So I don't know if it's his mistress, his love interest, his future wife, whatever you want to call it, but he has a relationship with her, and that character's name is Ann Morton, played by Ruth Roman. And then there's Barbara Morton, which is her younger sister, who is Patricia Hitchcock, that's Hitchcock's daughter. And then the senator, their father, Leo Carroll. What did you think of the three of them as kind of like supporting characters, and what they added to the film, and did those characters work for you?
I didn't know that was Hitchcock's daughter. That's interesting, but it also kind of makes sense because she was the one kind of, you know, going in and almost explaining what was happening pretty verbatim,
right?
Know, just pointing it out. I thought his love interest is, you know, his future wife. I really liked her character because it was good seeing someone who was able to put the pieces together and figure things out on their own. And, you know, seeing Bruno act the way he did, connect the dots, but at the same time, also still trust Guy. Like it didn't like artificially create like this separation, like, you know,
like all of a sudden I hate you.
That she believed him, which I guess there's different ways of taking that, but I really liked her character because I thought it made the story, that going back to, like I said, like the conversations, feeling like, oh, these are the type of conversations you always want these characters to have. She was a big part of that. How about yourself?
Yeah, I actually did enjoy Patricia Hitchcock as well. I thought that she added, like, yes, she is doing some explaining of different things in that manner, but I thought she added like a little bit of levity to some dark themes that we're kind of going through. And I thought she added, not necessarily from like a comedic standpoint, but I thought from a levity standpoint, like just lightening the mood a little bit, helped out a little bit. And I thought that the senator too, like it was believable. Like, I don't think that was overplayed. I think there was some restraint shown there too. Like, he is a senator and he does like try to help out in the ways that you would expect somebody of in a position of power to help out, but it's not like this, like, untouchable, like he can do anything he wants, he's just going to save the day type depiction of a senator as well. So like I kind of enjoyed the trio of them, and they all bring like a little bit of a different aspect to the film, which I appreciated.
I that whole family, I think it was really important for the story to work as well as it did.
And then you have Casey Rogers, who plays his current wife, who I thought did a good job of coming across as unlikable from Go. Like,
yes.
Like that whole sequence at her workplace or whatever it was like, oh, this person's like despicable in a way, like not in the same way that obviously Bruno is, but yeah. But Miriam's definitely not a likable character, which I think added a lot because that was helping you to like see like a strand of, or like if you follow this one strand, like how this could impact Guy's decision making for the rest of the film. Or at least from that first part, and if he's going to decide to like join in on this or not. So I thought, like, I don't think they're as fun as the side characters that we got in the 39 Steps, but I don't think they needed to be. I think they added stuff, so it wasn't like just characters that I didn't care about, like which we saw. Well, one of my complaints in Rope was that some of those characters at this party really added nothing, in my opinion, to the overall plot or the overall feel of the film, where I feel like each one here does. Even the detective or police captain or whichever, I don't know what his rank was, but the one that's kind of tailing them and following them, and they all know that, and they're like riding together in the cars and stuff like that. Like, I thought even him like added a little bit of something to the film, where it's like, yeah, I'm not saying like any of them are like these standout, like knock them dead, like steal the show type supporting characters, but they all had a purpose, and I felt like they all added something. Like, even you could go as far as like there's a, I don't know if it was a party or what was going on, what the occasion was or what the reason for the occasion was, but they're at an event basically at, I'm assuming, the senator's house. I'm trying to remember specifics about the movie, though, where there's a lot of folks there that Bruno kind of crashes. And he's talking to, you know, a number of women, like older women and stuff like that, and having fun and trying to, like, you know, really chew on that scene a little bit. And then leads to him actually pretend choking one of them. Even those women, like, I felt like they were well done and well placed and like added something to like the, how you can be close to this individual and let him in and like lower your defenses to the point where he's literally almost killing one of them on the couch. So like, I appreciated that. What about you for some of these other like supporting cast?
Yeah, I thought the cast overall was pretty strong, even, you know, like, and also played a big role. Even going back to the carnival, I liked how you had a little scenes that ended up coming back, because you have, when Bruno ends up making that murder, you have this guy that spots him and sees him, and you and he clocks him. You wonder if that's going to come back again, and it does. And that's something I think Hitchcock is really good at, is like foreshadowing or kind of leaving those seeds, or having his little pieces of trinkets that come back. Like, you know, this time being a lighter. Like, he likes using lighters a lot. I don't know why, but
I did feel like the lighter was a little bit of a, I don't want to call it a MacGuffin necessarily, but it was like a little bit of like a stretch. Like, we're going to plant this one lighter, and that's going to mean that you're going to be found guilty, because nothing's going to happen to that lighter. And then somebody's magically going to find it, give it to the police. Yeah. Like, I'm like, okay, we'll just go with it.
Yeah. And of course he's going to drop it in a drain, and you know, you have to, there was, you know, it was certainly
was a bit much.
Yeah. We're going to drop it in the drain. Arms. And, yeah. Yeah. That's, definitely, you know, Hitchcock likes to, you know, although the script, I think the overall creation of the story was good, there were those moments where it's like, okay, we gotta like throw some stuff in here that may be a little bit too much, but you know, I was in for the ride there, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned like the tennis sequences and how there's, you know, seeing, how did you think overall, like, obviously they're not a huge part of the story except for the ending, where obviously, you know, you have the tennis game and it's kind of like building tension overall. Like, how did you feel those were done? Because it's, you know, this is the first time we've gotten a Hitchcock film where you have, you know, sports playing such a major role.
Yeah, I not expecting it, but I wasn't expecting it to last as long as it did. Like, they actually stay with that for quite some time, it feels like. Which I guess is like trying to add to the tension, because, you know, he's trying to win this game like as quick as possible. And obviously it doesn't go his way because he's being distracted and, you know, it's affecting him. But I thought, like, from the way it was shot, it was done fairly well. And from the decisions to either have the, I guess Hitchcock went to like a tennis tournament and like filmed some stuff from like far away type things to get some realistic stuff. Then you have obviously the use of like showing the crowd and showing them following the ball back and forth, which seems like a really boring thing, but it somehow works at times as long as it's done right. And then seeing like the folks in the crowd that are just following it versus those that are maybe distracted on other things, which is where I got the parallel to the Challengers from 2024. But I thought it was done well. Like it helps that the one guy playing opposite of him is a tennis professional. Mm-hmm. And I guess he was used to help coach, I'm going to forget his name, but Guy is the actor that plays Guy Haynes. Like he helps coach him and then plays the other part. So I think there was enough there that like made it work. Like I was glad it didn't go on any longer. I thought it maybe had overstayed its welcome at one point, but like I was pleasantly surprised for someone that's not like a, you know, I know what tennis is and I've played it in like gym class, but I'm like not a tennis aficionado. So like,
yeah, and it was interesting too, cause it didn't like explain it at all. Like you kind of, you know, in a sense of like who was winning and that was part of like the game.
Right.
I thought that was interesting. One of my favorite shots in the entire movie was not the final tennis game, but the, you know, in the middle where you have Bruno showing up to the tennis match and you see everyone's head moving back and forth with the game, but him like just looking straight on. I thought that was really effective. Like that felt like one of those iconic Hitchcock moments. And I think that's something that this had on a number of occasions, that being one of them, that something, you know, Rope I felt like didn't. So
yeah, I agree with that. And I think it worked. I do have to comment, like I don't know if they ever explain how far apart these two places are, like the place that Bruno is from and the place that Guy is at with his with the senator and all that stuff. But this Bruno guy is getting to and from places with no problem. Like it's I know it's a movie and it has to like work that way, but there was a couple times where I was like, how far away is this? Because we had like the long train ride, but then this guy's going back and forth with like seemingly ease, like it's like next door.
Yeah. They must have a lot of I guess they did have a lot of trains back then, but they still seem to have a lot of trains.
Right. So this one obviously is well received when it goes. I didn't do as much of looking at the actual time, the contemporary reviews of it while it was out. I don't know if you did that or not for this one.
No, I didn't do it for this one. No.
As far as like overall Rotten Tomatoes, I think it has like a 98%. Obviously, it's well received as one of the films that makes Hitchcock, you know, the iconic director that he is known to be. Roger Ebert called it one of his 5 best films. It's on like a billion lists, so I'm not going to list them all because it's just, you know, all the different lists, like the movies you need to see before you die and all the greatest lists. So it's well received. It was actually one of his first box office success films is what I read. How do you feel like once all is said and done, like this stacks up with, you know, the ones that you've seen before, or at least the ones we've covered here before? Like I had a feeling, because I was really torn on this one at one point, and I'll try to explain why. But the first third maybe of this film, or the first like quarter of it, I had this overwhelming feel of like we had leveled up. Like I've nothing against the films that we have watched previous to this, but it seemed like I'm not saying like overall it was better or worse, but I felt like from a filmmaking standpoint, from a production standpoint, from a like all the things that Hitchcock is known for, I was like, oh, we are like on another level now. Like we've arrived at something different. And I was like really hooked in from the beginning because I was like, I don't know, I just felt like we had gone up an echelon or something like that. Now, I don't know if it's as rewatchable as, or if I had as much fun with it as I did with maybe a couple of his other films, but I'm not saying that makes it a worse film. I'm really torn on how I like come down and rank this film amongst the other ones that we've talked about. Not that I want to give away like every time we talk about a film where we all rank it all, and then, you know, we get to the final of this retrospective, there won't be any suspense, which would be ironic, I guess. But how did this one work for you overall? Did you have a feel that this was like on a different level or made in a superior fashion compared to the others, or did it just kind of fit in with everything we've watched?
I think it, I don't know if I said it leveled up completely, because I It's interesting looking at what we've seen so far, because you look at something like, not Rope, but the movie beforehand, which felt Notorious. More like a Notorious, which was, at the time, people more serious. It was more of a relationship drama, where this, to me, felt like when, like Hitchcock, when you think Hitchcock, you think thriller, and this felt like Hitchcock. It just felt like the type of atmosphere you'd want from him. Like, as I mentioned, like those number of scenes where it, you had great amount of tension just because he was allowing those scenes to play out. So I think in the sense of just on a thriller aspect, or, you know, feeling like you're getting that guy that kind of commands the screen, makes you nervous throughout, that definitely felt like the most, that's just so far, this is a movie that has done that the most. Mm-hmm. Now overall quality wise, or, you know, the general story, I don't know if I'd say leveled up compared to some of the other stuff, but on the sense of like exciting moments or scenes, like this to me had the most thus far. But I think Notorious was a very different film, mm-hmm. that showed a very different side of him. So I think this to me is getting in more into like
the what he's going for type deal.
Yeah,
I can see that. So obviously both of us do some reading on the films beforehand. Was there any little like bits of trivia that you had come across that you hadn't had a chance to share yet about this film? And then I had a couple and then a couple more questions for you as well.
The only thing I really saw, and we talked about already, was how in that final casino, in the sequence at the end where the guy was really crawling under the actual carousel, and how that, mm-hmm. you know, wasn't so that I didn't know. That was interesting, but that's the only thing I saw regarding.
Yeah, and apparently Hitchcock said that was the most dangerous stunt ever performed under his direction, and that he would never allow it to be done again. So I guess it was somewhat scary for those people that were involved with it as well. I didn't know this was a thing, but I read that there's a sequence basically between Ruth Roman and Patricia Hitchcock. Those are the two sisters at the tennis match where they give and show an actual real U.S. $10 bill. I did not know that was illegal unless you got permission from the U.S. Treasury Department. And it wasn't until like 8 or 9 years later for Psycho that they had removed that like legality. But apparently back in the day, you couldn't show real money on a film. So that was interesting to me. This was the last completed acting role for Robert Walker, who plays Bruno Anthony. He dies 8 months after filming. From an allergic reaction to a drug used to treat his alcoholism is one version of the story, but there seems to be multiple versions of the story that say that it was that there was maybe something else involved. It's kind of a whole little mystery and some suspense, I guess, about how he died. But the interesting thing, and the reason why I brought it up, was because he does have another film. And I found it interesting that there's a film called My Son John that came out in 1952, the next year, that he had filmed some stuff, and then they had to like try to figure out how to finish it. So obviously they rewrote part of the script, they did different things, but they actually use outtakes from this film and like put it in their film with Hitchcock's permission in order to like complete the film. So I've never seen My Son John, but I'd be interested to see that and see if you could pick out like which parts were actually from Strangers on a Train instead, just to make it work for that. Like, that's kind of interesting. And then there was two other ones that I wanted to mention. Casey Rogers, who is the one that plays Guy's actual wife. And there's a thing there between Casey Rogers and Hitchcock's daughter, Patricia, where they're both wearing like very thick glasses, like almost like those Coke bottle glasses. And apparently Casey Rogers has like perfect vision, but putting those on made her completely blind. So like that she had to have like all kinds of assistance and be guided when she was wearing those to like help make sure she didn't like have accidents, fall over. And I guess if I was to rewatch it, they say you can watch the sequences she's in, and there may be a couple of times where you see her like running her hand like along a table or a wall or a chair or something, which was her doing it on purpose to try to like make sure she knew where she was and like not run into things and stuff like that. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And then one of the older ladies that's on the couch, I don't know if it's the one that gets choked or if it's just one of the ones that's sitting next. I didn't do enough research on that. But this was her final film. I find this crazy, though. So this actress had an 18-year career in Hollywood or in film. She appears in 77 films. 65 of which she's uncredited in, including this one. So 65 out of the 77 films she doesn't get credit for. I mean, I'm sure now that she's listed, I'm sure they picked her out and like she's on the IMDb for just as uncredited, but like that's crazy to have that long of a career and only have 12 of your appearances out of 77 actually have your name on the film. So the other one, which is the one I wanted to ask you a question about, because I didn't necessarily pick up on this, but we did mention it when we talked about Rope. I don't think we talked about it with Notorious or the 39 Steps, but I did read one trivia bit that says Alfred Hitchcock and Robert Walker, who plays Bruno Anthony, worked out an elaborate series of gestures and physical appearance to suggest the homosexuality and seductiveness of Bruno's character while not getting caught by like the censors of the time. Did you pick up on any of that when you watched this, or did you sense, like, I know we kind of did a little bit with Rope, but did you sense it at all when you were watching this one?
A little bit. Like, I think mostly kind of a little bit with this portrayal, or at least in the way that I feel like people viewed homosexuals at the time and like in his relationship with his mother. I felt like that was kind of, you know, how, I don't know. And how he felt very antagonistic against his father. So I felt like if those pieces were meant to hint at, like, you know, maybe his father, his issues with his father, because perhaps that's a reason. It wasn't as, I think, as overt by any stretch of the imagination as Rope was, but I could, as you say that, looking back on it, I could, some things are starting to click a little bit.
Yeah. And then last question for you. If you had to choose one, if you had to choose either Bruno's mom in this or the villain's mom from Notorious to be your mom, which one would you choose?
I guess you got to give Bruno's mom credit for trusting her boy, right? I mean,
and I guess her hobbies are just painting. She's not like plotting death and destruction.
She's not a Nazi, so I'm gonna go with her. I guess that's
good choice.
That's gonna give her the win. So,
and then last question before we round this one out: what's the over under on how many more people? We have 6 films to cover still. The over under on how many instances of strangling we're gonna see for the rest of the way out?
6 films. Oh man, I would put the over under at 6.5. You know, at least one per movie. So
he likes the strangling, that's for sure. Hitchcock is employing that a lot. Oh, I did forget too that I think there might have been an instance where we would have also had a Hitchcock blonde in this film, but apparently he was ruled against. He didn't have any choice on the, it seemed like he didn't have any choice on these casting for Ruth Roman, who plays the like the love interest, because at the time, like, you had to basically choose actors or actresses that the studio employed, which seems like something that's so far removed from like today, obviously. So they basically had to use an actress, or the studio basically forced him to use it. And I guess he was very vocal about not liking her and not wanting her up as a part of the film. And there's a few actors that were involved in the film that basically said that like he did not treat her very well on set, things of that nature. So I wonder if that's where he wanted like another one of his Hitchcock blondes. That's a complete inference. I have no idea if there's anything to that, but I did find it interesting too, because they did get permission to borrow, I guess is the term they used, one of the other actors. I think it was the Robert Walker character, Bruno Anthony. I think he was borrowed from another studio, but it's just kind of a crazy studio system that was existing back in the 50s. Were you aware of that before?
Just from reading different things and like either movies or story or books that took place during that time, that whole studio era. And you know, you especially like Judy Garland and those stars, and they had these crazy contracts, and that's who you worked for, that's who you were signed with. And you know, it's almost like it was more akin to like the way sports stars are treated now. Yeah. You know, you'd sign with a franchise, they'd have like people they try to bring up, and you know, start them, you know, put them in different, you know, movies to help forward their career and then try to make them into massive stars. Yeah, it was like the whole studio era is crazy, good and bad. It's just there's a lot of interesting documentaries about it. So,
all right, any final thoughts on Strangers on a Train?
No, it just makes you realize. Don't talk to people you don't know on trains, because
which they do show you too. At the end of the film.
Yeah,
it's better to just walk away into the other car, I guess. The other car.
Yeah.
Don't dine in somebody's personal car. Like you have to go to the dining car, or wait the 20 minutes until it's available.
It's better, you can't do this option. Movie now because like people don't use public transit as much, and when they do, that's they're true. On their phones. Or so
yeah, it would never have happened. I did. Yeah. That was also like I completely didn't see the whole thing happening with the guy that. Like he's using as his witness. Like,
yeah,
I didn't see that coming either because I didn't realize how inebriated I guess he was at the time when he's watching all of that. And I'm like, oh, I guess that's not going to work. So yeah, another interesting chapter in our Hitchcock filmography. Next time we're going to be going a few years into the future. I think this one was released in 1951. We're going to move to 1954 for Hitchcock's Dial M. For Murder. Dan, I know we do this every time, but have you seen Dial M for Murder before?
I have. Actually, I realized because I had it wasn't a box set, but it was like a DVD set of like Hitchcock movies, and Dial M for Murder as well as Strangers on a Train was on both. So that's how I watched both of them.
Nice. Nice. Well, it'll be a first time watch for me. So I'm looking forward to it to see like where we go from there and see if we get anybody strangled in that one or not. As far as how people can stay in contact with you, reach out to you, get questions or see other content that you create, Dan, how can people do that?
Just search Comic Concierge on all the different platforms, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky. There's so many, so many things. So how about yourself?
You can search out either Optimus Solo for my Twitter and that type of thing. Or if you want to see some of the other nerdy content I put out, you can search out the Geek Showcase. There's a bunch of different types of stuff there that maybe you will find interesting. You can also search the show out at the Cinema Geeks. You can search Cinema Geeks on all the different social medias. Well, maybe not as many as Dan just listed, but as far as a few of the main ones. And then you can also stay in touch with the website that we're hosted on, the Geekcast Radio Network, where they do a lot of other content along the world of geekdom, cartoons, video games, and all kinds of other stuff. So that does it for this episode of the Cinema Geeks. Tune in next time for another chance to listen to more Hitchcock talk from the Cinema Geeks.